Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides. And once again this week, I am riding solo. Unfortunately, again, schedules just did not work out. And Josh is not available, and so it is just going to be me. So we're going to get through this together, you and me, the listener. So this is going to be fun. I want to welcome you to the show. Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. And on today's episode, we're going to be discussing Strikeforce Overeem versus Verdun, which took place on June 18th, 2011 at the American Airlines Arena in Dallas, Texas. The main event would feature a rematch between Strikeforce heavyweight champion The Demolition Man, Alistair Overeem, and Fabricio Verdun in a quarterfinal bout in the promotion's heavyweight Grand Prix. In the co-main event, which was also a quarterfinal bout, we would see the baby-faced assassin Josh Barnett make his Strikeforce debut against Brett the Grim Rogers. We would also get two Grand Prix reserve bouts with Chad the Gravedigger Griggs tangling with Alistair's brother, Valentine Overeem, and Daniel Cormier taking on former UFC heavyweight title challenger Jeff the Snowman Munson. Lastly, we would get a fight with fireworks written all over it in Jorge Masvidal versus KJ Nunes. Did want to quickly mention Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out the other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com. But as we like to do, we're going to talk about the fallout from the last Strikeforce event, the last major one before this. It was Strikeforce Diaz versus Daly, and man, quite an auspicious start to the Zuffa era of Strikeforce, if you will. We'd seen the last of Strikeforce's welterweight champion Nick Diaz inside the Hexagon as he would move over to the UFC after his scintillating win over Paul Daly. Gilbert Melendez had returned after a year away from the cage to take a dominating TKO win over Tatsuya Kawajiri, spoiling the Japanese star's North American debut. Shinya Aoki had made what would be his final Strikeforce appearance, quickly submitting Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbomb, who also wouldn't return to the promotion. And we also got a war that ended in a majority draw between Gegard Mousasi and the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine. That is the fight to watch on that card, in my opinion, just overall. Gilbert's win is huge, and Nick versus Daly was an awesome one-round fight. So, there, I mean, really, all the fights had something to offer. I mean, it was good stuff, but I really enjoyed the Mousasi-Jardine fight. So, all right, but let's get back to what we're talking about today. There were a bunch of fighters expected to appear on this card that did not, so let's quickly kind of run through them. King Mo was announced to be fighting Ovince St. Preux, but Mike Aframovitz, the communications head for Strikeforce, said that was actually an accident, was never supposed to be announced. Not sure what happened there, but King Mo would end up fighting on a future card. Scott Smith, Hands of Steel, also had said he planned to compete on the card, but he would instead fight Tarek Safadi in the next month at Fedor versus Henderson. Originally, Daniel Cormier was supposed to battle fellow undefeated rising star Shane Del Rosario on this card in a reserve bout. However, Del Rosario had to pull out due to a car accident that he had suffered in early May, and stepping in to replace Del Rosario against DC would be former UFC heavyweight title challenger, the aforementioned Jeff Monson. Apparently, the accident that Del Rosario had been in was pretty bad. His car was totaled by a drunk driver. He suffered a herniated disc in his back, which actually ended his Strikeforce career. As he would move over to the UFC the following year, he would not do well there. As we've discussed about Shane on a previous episode, he sadly would pass away due to heart issues in 2013. Very, very sad situation that had taken place there. There were a lot of contributing factors, including some opioids and that sort of thing. So unfortunately, Shane really never got back on track and really was, he I believe lost both his fights in the UFC and suffered some injuries and that sort of thing. So rest in peace, Mr. Del Rosario. Now, many may not remember this, but Amanda Nunes, who is considered by most, if not the greatest female fighter of all time, at this point, you know, she's the second, even though she beat Chris Cyborg, who many would consider the first. I mean, you kind of have to say that Nunes is the greatest female fighter in history. She had two fights in Strikeforce, actually, early in her career. She was scheduled to fight Julie Kedzie on this card, but she suffered a hairline fracture in her foot, and that forced her to step away from the bout, unfortunately. And then finally, Gina Carano was not only scheduled to be on this card, but she was actually on the fight poster. This was, you know, this was signed, sealed, delivered. She was going to be fighting Sara de Alelio. However, while she was medically approved by the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation, Carano had some sort of medical issue, and her doctors decided that it would be best for her not to fight. And so she pulled out on the advice of her own doctors, and not kind of shrouded in mystery a bit. Not a lot of information out there on it, but we would not see Carano. And as I believe you probably know, we never actually saw Carano fight again. She, after the 2009 loss in August of that year to Chris Cyborg, there were rumors of her coming back to Strikeforce. Again, she was signed and was going to come back on this card. And then, you know, later she was actually supposed to fight Ronda Rousey in the UFC, and things with Dana White didn't work out so well. And so Carano never fought again. It's hard to believe, but as of this recording, it's been, 12 years since she fought. And obviously at 38, she's done. She's an actress now, but she came oh so close to coming back at least one more time, and it just didn't end up happening. All right, let's get to the fight itself. Let's get to the event itself. As mentioned earlier, Strikeforce Overeem versus Werdum took place on June 18, 2011 at the American Airlines Arena in Dallas, Texas. There were 7,639 fans in attendance, drawing a total gate of $543,060. It was broadcasted on Showtime, and the event drew 624,000 average viewers with a peak of 719,000 fans. And once again on the call, we would get Gus Johnson alongside Mara Rinaldo and Frank Shamrock. I did want to mention during the broadcast, they for some reason kept showing, pockets of the arena where there were there were a lot of empty seats, basically. So kind of interesting that they kept showing that. And, knowing that Zuffa was behind it didn't seem to really do much good as far as drawing more fans. I mean, obviously, most promotions out there would love, besides the UFC and Bellator, would love to have 7,600 fans in attendance today. But, obviously when the UFC is drawing double that and, in some cases, well more than that, this didn't bode well for them long term once again. All right, let's get to the undercard. Isaac Valley Flag defeated Brian Melancone via split decision at 175 pounds. At another catchweight bout, 180 pounds, Nashawn Burrell defeated Joe Ray via unanimous decision. 155 pounds, we saw the return of Connor Hewn. He defeated Magno Almeida via unanimous decision. And then at 155 pounds in a bout that was seen as having, planned to have a big impact on the lightweight division, Jay-Z Cavalcante versus Justin Wilcox ended in a very unfortunate no contest due to an accidental eye poke that was suffered by Wilcox. Jay-Z was asked about this, and he said it was in the second round. He felt like he was losing the fight. Actually, didn't feel like he was doing all that great, but he did feel like he was coming on strong and then just accidentally poked Wilcox in the eye, excuse me. And Wilcox was unable to continue that. So that was the end of that. We also had a rare post main card bout. Mike Bronsoulis defeated Todd Moore via unanimous decision. That again took place after the main card, which was at this point that we'd seen that a fair amount early on in Strikeforce. And this was the first time, I want to say in years at this point, that we saw that. So kind of interesting there. But let's get to the main card. So the opening bout, heavyweight bout, this is again was a reserve bout. The winner would be an option to step in just in case one of the other competitors got injured and couldn't appear for one reason or another. And this was Chad Griggs taking on Valentine Overeem. Griggs was 10-1 coming in with 9 knockouts and was undefeated at 5-0 in his last 5 bouts. This included wins over Bobby Lashley and John Volante. Which, as for the firefighter that Griggs was a firefighter, this was a big step up in terms of experience. Both Lashley and Volante were fairly early in their careers, and Valentine Overeem, extremely experienced at 29-25 coming in. He had wins over Randy Couture and Babalu Sobral early on in his MMA efforts, and he was 28 of his 29 wins had come via stoppage. So he was a finishing machine. When he would win, he usually won by finish. Definitely somebody to keep an eye on. Overeem had won 3 straight, which included a neck crank submission victory over Ray Sefo in his Strikeforce debut. So this promised to be hopefully this would be a pretty entertaining fight. Early on, Overeem grabbed a clinch. Griggs was able to turn and fall to the mat, rolling through, twisting his body, and ending up in top position. It was really actually pretty smooth, kind of a judo-type move, and I enjoyed seeing that. The Python did a nice job of tying Griggs up for a while, but eventually the Gravedigger was able to free himself and started dropping some heavy shots from the top, which forced Overeem to tap out, which moved Griggs to 3-0 in Strikeforce. And interestingly, at first the announcers seemed to miss the tap out, and Morrow said, he was about ready to complain about a quick stoppage and was just ready to rip into the ref. But then on replay, saw the tap out and changed his tune immediately to his credit. So Chad Griggs defeated Valentine Overeem via submission, coming by way of strikes at 208 of the first round. It was actually announced as a TKO, but was recorded, fortunately, as a submission, because that's actually what it was. So then cage side, they showed former Dallas Cowboys stars Herschel Walker and Michael Irvin, as well as Strikeforce competitors Misha Tate and Bigfoot Silva. But as far as these two, this would actually be it for both of these guys. In Strikeforce, Griggs would move over to the UFC the following year and compete twice. He got submitted at heavyweight by Travis Brown before moving down to light heavyweight, got tapped out by Cyril Diabate, and that ended his career at 11-3. Kind of interesting that he would have such a healthy career record and had some big wins on his tally, but that would be it. Overeem would continue to compete until 2014, winning only one more fight, retiring with a record of 33-35. All of those fights after this Strikeforce fight, all those fights came outside of the U.S., and judging by a couple of the fight posters I saw, I have a feeling that that may have had something to do with drug testing. He was a big, beefy boy for sure. All right, 265 pounds heavyweight bout, the other reserve bout, Daniel Cormier versus Jeff Munson, as with the Griggs Overeem bout. Again, the winner of this fight would potentially come into play as a replacement if one of the other competitors couldn't go on a later fight card. Jeff the Snowman Munson was 42-11 with 26 submission victories, and he was on an 8-fight win streak. He was a former Abu Dhabi submission wrestling champion. This guy, Munson, was a serious threat. I mean, he was a guy, if he got you to the ground, big, he was only 5'9", but man, he was just thick, just powerful guy. Longtime veteran of the sport. He had made his MMA debut all the way back in 1997. And after a three-fight win streak in the UFC, he had challenged Tim Sylvia for the UFC heavyweight title at UFC 65 in Sacramento in 2006. I was there for that. Actually, I was not involved with MMA at that time. I had just become a big fan. And I remember that Munson came out to the cage to the strains of Imagine from John Lennon, which really stood out to me. I didn't know anything about him at all. I mean, but I was used to hearing, Rage Against the Machine and death metal and, maybe hardcore hip hop or that sort of thing. So to hear, the piano of Imagine by John Lennon it just really stood out to me. But knowing what I know about him now, this didn't actually mean it meant something to him. Munson he's really one of the most unique personalities in MMA history. He's been labeled as an anarchist. Actually got in trouble for spray painting U.S. property, I believe, in 2011. But he actually rejects that label. He doesn't consider himself to be an anarchist. He's not for eradicating the government. He's just really believes in everybody having an equal share. And so what it describes to me, what it sounds like to me, is really more of socialism mixed with some communism. I've never really dived too deep into him. I know that he is a citizen of Russia, and he's very into Russia, and I think he lives there. So, he's a very unique guy. I probably don't agree with a lot of his politics, but very, very interesting guy. As for DC, he was 7-0 at the time. He was a 2-time U.S. Olympic wrestler. He was also undefeated at 4-0 in Strikeforce. And this was his first time competing on the main card of one of Strikeforce's major events. So this was a big opportunity for him. I did want to mention Munson had some big wins in his career, including victories over Kazuyuki Fujita, the Smashing Machine Mark Kerr, Rico Rodriguez, Roy Nelson, and Sergey Kharitonov. So this would be a huge test for Daniel Cormier, and we would see how he would do. Cormier seemed pretty intent on showing off his hands in the first round, put together some really nice combinations on the feet. He did cut Munson on the top of the head with an accidental headbutt, which drew a fair amount of blood. No takedown attempts from either side in that first round. Clear 10-9 Cormier round to open things up. In the second round, we saw more stand-up with Munson opening up and getting out of the pocket in terms of striking. At one point, the Snowman slipped after a big swing and was on his back. Somewhat surprisingly, DC didn't follow him down to the mat, although I guess in retrospect it would make sense, as that was really Munson's world. Cormier seemed to be in better shape overall, and that only became more clear as Munson got hit more and more. Definitely 10-9 for DC in the second round. Really surprising that there were no takedown attempts from either side heading into the third round. Cormier opened things up a little bit with a really nice couple pair of combinations, and even landed a really nice Superman punch that looked like it hurt Munson. Just a really strong performance for DC on the feet, which really showed his growth as an MMA fighter at that stage of his career. But after getting dropped, Munson shot in for a takedown. DC was able to avoid very nice takedown defense. Cormier then clinched against the cage for a while, and after some nice knees, he turned and sort of hip-tossed Munson to the mat, kind of kind of what we saw with the Gravedigger and Alistair's brother Valentine in the first fight. But he just really just seemed to just be really in a good spot physically and mentally. And DC was just having his way with the former UFC title challenger. Clean sweep on the scorecards in my mind, 30-27 for DC. And that was the official decision. Daniel Cormier defeated Jeff Munson via unanimous decision. But I did want to mention, so due to some reshuffling that we'll discuss on a future episode, Cormier would actually get an opportunity to step in for one of the competitors of the Grand Prix. So we would actually see him back in just a few months. Munson, for his part, was one and done with the promotion. He last competed in MMA in 2016, going out with a win to bring his record to 61-26-2, but he's still competing in martial arts, doing grappling tournaments and that sort of thing. And he actually, just as we record this in November of 2021, he just lost a pro boxing bout a few weeks ago, in October of 2021. So pretty amazing that I believe he's 52 years old and he's still competing. So my hat's off to him. All right, at 155 pounds, Jorge Masvidal taking on KJ Nunes. Masvidal came into this one 21-6 on his record, but he was on an uneven run as he had split his last four bouts. As for Nunes, after a busy 2010, he had broken his hand in his title loss against Nick Diaz the previous year, so he'd taken some time to heal off. He'd taken some time off to heal up. Prior to the Diaz loss, he had won six straight at lightweight, his more natural weight class, so he was definitely in the conversation for a title shot with a win here against Masvidal. All right, once the bell rang, no feeling out process in this one. These two went right at it, with Masvidal even trying out that now signature flying knee a few times. After both Masvidal and Nunes had their moments on the feet, Gamebred grabbed a nice takedown. He wasn't able to do much with it, but once things got back to the feet, Masvidal landed a nice short knee to a ducking Nunes. It cut him pretty good. And then late in the round, Gamebred timed a kick perfectly as Nunes was ducking down to change levels and nailed him flush in the face. Nunes dropped as the crowd roared and Gamebred followed up. Nunes was hurt badly, but he was able to survive to the final bell, although he was now sporting the proverbial crimson mask, probably a 10-8 round for Gamebred. Nunes did seem to be fine to his credit at the beginning of the second round, but you could see that his left eye was swelling. Of course, it didn't take long for his forehead to start bleeding again, and Nunes did land a nice left uppercut that got a reaction from Masvidal, who reacted a short time later with another really nice takedown, followed up by another one after Nunes was able to stand up. But, whoo, Nunes' face was an absolute mess. You could see a large hematoma forming on the right side of his forehead just above his eye, and along with the swelling eye and all the blood, I mean, he was in really rough shape. But to his credit, Nunes was the one that was pressing the action, a lot of countering from Masvidal, who was still, you know, despite not being the aggressor, all those counter strikes, they were doing most of the damage, which was evidenced by another killer jumping knee from the Cuban fighter, 10-9 for Gamebred in the second round. That hematoma at the beginning of the third round, it just looked brutal. It was really bad. But Nunes was pressing things more in the third and final round, again, still being very aggressive, and just what a display of toughness on his part. The two continued to trade strikes on the feet, with neither getting really any big highlight moments after a fight full of them. And Masvidal got another couple of takedowns as the round wore on. He seemed content to play it safe and not take risks, knowing that he was definitely winning the fight. And this is where things would end. A great win for Masvidal, who simply beat up KJ Nunes. Lots of respect between the two afterwards, but Gamebred was clearly in the running for a title shot. And he was asked on the mic in the post-fight interview about this, and he said he wasn't going to call out Gilbert Melendez for a title shot, but he would definitely take one if Scott Coker would grant it to him. And but both Masvidal and Nunes would ironically be back on the same card in later in the year, December of 2011, with KJ battling a Billy Evangelista, who had lost to Masvidal in his previous strike force bout, and then Masvidal would get that title shot against Gilbert Melendez. So I'm looking forward to covering that. All right, we are at the co-main event, Josh Barnett versus Brett Rogers. Barnett was a former UFC heavyweight champion. He was 29-5 with 7 knockouts and 17 submissions on his record. According to Mauro Ranallo, he was the only fighter in MMA history to test positive for steroids 3 times in his career at that point, with one of those tests costing him his newly won UFC heavyweight title at that time. And then another one, he had a main event fight against Fedor Emelianenko, an affliction that was lined up a couple years prior to this, and that had been canceled. And I believe the entire event had been canceled because of his positive steroid test. Still with wins over Dan Severn, Sammy Schilt, Alexander Emelianenko, Mark Hunt, and Rodrigo Nogueira. Plus, being on a 6-fight win streak, he was a dangerous foe for anyone. And I would like to say Josh Barnett is one of my, I don't want to say he's one of my favorite MMA fighters, but he's a heavyweight that I really like. I love that he's not a bodybuilder type, but he's just really strong. He always had good cardio. I love catch wrestling, which they talked about during his bout, that, you know, kind of just what's the difference between jiu-jitsu and catch wrestling. Catch wrestling, while jiu-jitsu is, you know, kind of like be like water, as Bruce Lee would say, in terms of martial arts, you kind of use your opponent's force against them, that you kind of flow with it, that sort of thing. Catch wrestling is the opposite. Catch wrestling is about imposing your will. It's about being aggressive. You're aggressively going to, for submissions, rather than kind of playing the mental chess game or the physical chess game and waiting for an opportunity to present itself. So really, really interesting. Rogers, for his part, was 11-2 with 9 knockouts and 1 submission coming in. And after a real strong start to his career that saw him destroy Ubongo Humphrey and Andrei Arlovsky, the Grim had fallen on hard times inside the hexagon, losing via punches to Fedor Emelianenko and Alistair Overeem. He did have some moments in the Fedor fight, but really none in the Overeem fight. He seemed to be, if anything, regressing as a fighter. And he did come back with a win over journeyman and fellow Strikeforce veteran Ruben Warpath Villarreal. But, I mean, he was just facing a whole different animal in Josh Barnett. And during the I believe before the fight started, Mauro Ranallo was talking about Grim on the mic, and he was saying that, you know, this fight, I guess, had taken place up in Canada, and that he had not looked real good against Warpath. That was a very winnable fight that was probably designed to get a win under his belt and get him back on the right track. But apparently Rogers had not looked good in that fight. And so, his confidence probably wasn't real high coming into this. They made a point of saying that where he trained at in Minnesota, that there were no heavyweights his size. You got to train. You know, Frank Shamrock jumped and said, if you want to be the best, you have to train with the best. And so this didn't really bode well for him coming into this fight. And we'll put it this way. If I was a betting man and I knew all this going into this bout, I would have bet heavy on Josh Barnett. But anyways, Barnett, once the bell rang, grabbed Rogers early on, getting his arms around both legs and lifting the Grim off the mat, slamming him down. Very nicely done. And then, as is the case with catch wrestling, as I mentioned, Barnett was aggressively seeking submissions. Rogers almost got out from underneath him, but Barnett was able to get him back and eventually moved to full mount. And from there, Barnett mostly rode Rogers, dropping the occasional strike. Rogers would buck here and there, trying to get Barnett off him, but to no avail. And the big takedown was really the lone highlight in the first round, 10-9 Barnett. The crowd was not really appreciating what they were seeing, because Barnett would be in position and Rogers wouldn't really be able to do much. But Barnett wasn't really, he wasn't getting close on submissions or dropping big heavy leather or anything either. At the start of the second round, Rogers looked pretty winded, just, again, did not bode well for him. He did grab a clinch and push, but Barnett used that momentum and turned and flipped Rogers onto his back, landing in full mount. Super smooth. That kind of popped me. I really enjoyed seeing that. Again, we had already seen this two other times in the other heavyweight bouts with DC and Gravedigger both doing the same thing to their opponents, and both those guys had won. And so we would see very quickly that would be the case here as well. As just over a minute in, Barnett saw an opening, grabbed onto an arm triangle choke, and Rogers, you could see him panic, and he tapped out. Just a very nice win for Josh Barnett. We did have kind of a little funny moment post-fight where Mauro accidentally called Frank Ken, as in Ken Shamrock, his brother, who he was in a full-fledged feud with at that point. So, and Frank kind of got kind of quiet. He kind of chuckled, and then he, Mauro tried to make an excuse or kind of walk it back. And Frank's like, you're not getting out of that easy. And I was curious if Frank was actually upset with Mauro about that at all. Probably not, but it did make for kind of an awkward moment. So Gus Johnson goes in there to interview Barnett after the fight, and Barnett grabs the mic from him and basically says, hey Gus, I know you gotta love you. I know you got a job to do, but these people, they want to hear from me. And got a nice reaction from the crowd, and he cut super fiery baby face promo on the mic, saying that at the end of the tournament he'd be standing on a pile of bodies with a pile of gold in his hands. So that got a nice reaction from Josh Barnett. He also wished everybody a happy Father's Day, which was the next day. So pretty cool. The official result was Josh Barnett defeated Brett Rogers via submission, come by way of arm triangle choke at 1:17 of the second round. Barnett would be back to take on Sergei Kharitonov in the Grand Prix in a few months. while this would be it for Rodgers and Strikeforce, Rodgers would not as we. I'm sorry, Rodgers would not be back, as this would be all, you know, all she wrote there. And in September of that year, and this is interesting. So Rodgers walked to the cage, and I believe it was his wife that was accompanying him to the cage. In September of 2011, so just a few months after this, Rodgers would plead guilty to domestic abuse for choking and punching his wife into an unconsciousness the same month as this fight. I don't know if it occurred before or after this fight. I don't know. I would assume that it happened afterwards, just because his wife didn't have any appear to have any marks on her or anything like that. And you know, again, she was walking with her husband, and if he had, you know, abused her at that point, I don't know. But it doesn't seem like it. But their oldest daughter would also tell police that not only did he beat his wife, but he also beat his kids, and he got 60 days in jail plus probation and a fine, which it's offensive. I mean, the fact that he choked and beat his wife into unconsciousness, and this is 10 years ago, but choked and beat her, and he got 60 days and nights in jail plus probation and a fine. I mean, come on. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. But as far as his MMA career goes, he would continue to fight until 2015, after which he began having more brushes with the law. There were multiple accusations of groping men against their will. There was a situation at the library where he grabbed the genitals, I believe, of a male that worked for the library. Apparently was in the elevator, and when the man slapped his hand away, he didn't really say anything. And when the doors opened, he went out. And then he was also got some. While he was in jail, he was also accused of groping a fellow cellmate. And I unfortunately have not been able to find anything about what I tried to find. See if I can find anything about what's going on with him today. He ended his career at 17-10 in MMA. And so again, that last fight was in 2015. I have no idea what's going on with him. I have no idea if he's still married or, you know, involved with his kids' lives or anything like that. But it seems like he was in a really bad place, and I hope that he's gotten whatever help he needs. And listeners, if any of you know what's going on with him, reach out to me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. I'd love to know what's going on with him. But that brings us to our main event, Alistair Overeem versus Fabricio Werdum. As mentioned, this was a rematch, as Werdum had submitted Overeem in Pride back in 2006. And you got, I mean, at the, it was a, there, he was a, di- both these guys were different fighters at that point. And Werdum was interviewed before the fight saying, and basically said that, you know, we're both different guys. We were now seeing Overeem at his beefiest. I mean, he was a very solid, muscular 256 pounds. So he had bulked up a ton. That fight with Werdum, he was a glorified light heavyweight at that point, just beginning his run as a heavyweight. But at this point, he was full-fledged Uberim. I mean, he was swole in this one for sure. But Werdum seemed very, very confident that he'd be able to get the same result. He had also bulked up considerably as well. So, but the Demolition Man, he wanted payback in this one. He even requested this fight in his pre-fight interview. He was saying that he wanted this one. He wanted to get back at Werdum. But Overeem was 34-11-1 coming in. He was the only fighter at the time to hold world titles in kickboxing and MMA, and I believe that is still the case. He had not tasted defeat since 2007. He'd gone unbeaten in 10 straight. The first fight in that winning streak had actually netted him the Strikeforce Heavyweight Championship. Now, that belt would not be on the line in this fight, which is interesting because normally now when we see these Bellator Grand Prix tournaments, normally the belt is on the line every time the champion competes. But not very active in Strikeforce over the years due to a lack of viable heavyweight contenders. This was Overeem's chance to really establish himself as the man to beat in the heavyweight division in that promotion. And he had mentioned that getting some wins over these nice names would really get him set up. But he was really targeting a unification bout with Cain Velasquez. That's what he really, really wanted. Werdum was 14-4-1 coming in. He had not competed since submitting Fedor the previous year, so it was almost exactly a year before this. With that win, he had won 5 of his last 6, which included a decision win over Bigfoot Silva in Strikeforce. Silva, again, was cage side. The thought that was that Silva was going to challenge the winner of this bout, and obviously being able to take on the champion in Alistair Overeem would go a long way towards, you know, if he won that fight, man, he would obviously be the next contender for the heavyweight title. And then if he could get a bout with Werdum, that would give him a chance at getting some revenge against a guy that had beaten him. All right, but once the bell rang, Not the most exciting fight. Overeem clearly had no desire to go to the mat with Werdun. The Brazilian would end up on the mat, sometimes shooting, sometimes he'd get pushed over. But Alistair would never follow him down early on in the fight. The crowd was booing Werdun extensively as he would lay down on the mat until the ref made him get up. And it was clear Overeem, they both had their strategies. Overeem wanted to keep things standing, which made sense. And Werdun wanted to keep things on the mat, which made sense. So they both wanted the other guy to come to their world, and the other guy didn't want to. Every time they'd clinch, every time Werdun would pull the champ down to the mat, Overeem would get out of it, stand back out. He did not want to deal with that. He was really interesting to watch them get frustrated at each other. Werdun would almost lay down after getting hit, trying to draw Overeem in. And in fact, at one point, Overeem slammed Werdun down hard, but pulled back up, and Werdun from his back literally put his hands together in prayer, asking the Dutchman to follow him down, pointing, come on, come on. And he's smiling and big cheesy grin. And but the crowd was not enjoying this at all. Finally, at the end of the round, Werdun captured Overeem in his guard, but it was too late to do anything with it. So 10-9 Overeem for sure. In the second round, Werdun got some nice strikes in before ending up on his back. This time, Overeem actually engaged on the mat for a second, but when he felt Werdun trying to tie him up, he remembered his strategy and stood back up. And we had more of that, more of the same of this in the round with the crowd booing lustily. Overeem would land a strike. Werdun would fall to his back. Overeem would stand up. The ref would make Werdun come back up too. And towards the end of the round, Overeem did engage on the mat, so that was noteworthy, but Werdun was too tired and too hurt really to do anything with it. He had eaten some shots on the feet, so another 10-9 round for Overeem. And then in the third round, Fabricio was clearly tired. His left eye was swelling. He did aggressively land some good strikes early on before shooting in, though Overeem ended up on top. But, I mean, man, this was a boring fight. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. On the feet, Werdun did land some nice shots at times with his hands and knees. And I might have given Werdun the last round, but it wasn't enough. Overeem clearly won the fight, though neither fighter was really very impressive with this. So the official decision, Alistair Overeem defeated Fabricio Werdun via unanimous decision. Interestingly, neither of these guys would compete in Strikeforce again, with both moving over to the UFC. So this was, for this card, you had a bunch of guys that we did not see again. I mean, the opening guys, Chad Griggs and Valentine Overeem, they were both done. Jeff Munson, he was done after this one. Both the lightweights would be back. But then Josh Burnett versus Brett Rogers would be done. So there's really only three fighters that would continue on. Out of the heavyweights, there was only two that would continue on after this. So you got four heavyweight fights, so eight fighters, and only two of them would continue on with the promotion after this. So that's pretty crazy. But that's the way things went in the Zuffa era. So very unfortunate that's how it all went down. But Werdun, he would have a memorable run with the UFC after this that would see him capture wins over Rodrigo Nogueira, Mark Hunt, and Cain Velasquez, and got him the interim UFC heavyweight championship. He is still competing today at 44 years old with the Professional Fighters League, the PFL, and he holds a record of 24-9-1 in MMA. Overeem would also have a good run inside the octagon, garnering wins over Brock Lesnar, Frank Mir, Junior Dos Santos, Andrei Arlovsky, and another victory over Werdun. These two would actually lock up again. He left the UFC earlier this year in 2021, and he headed back to Glory to compete in kickboxing, and that's where he's probably going to wrap up his career. But that was the fight card. Really kind of unremarkable. Not a whole lot to really jump that really jumps out at you. There were no fighters that popped for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after this event, and unfortunately, no fighter payroll to discuss that was not released. Unsurprisingly, Masvidal versus Nunes was clearly the fight of the night. I mean, just such a great bout, just to see the toughness of Nunes and Masvidal with the extremely intelligent strategy that he had, the counter striking. And he said it after the bout that Nunes was just the right style for Nunes, in that, again, he was using his opponent's aggression against him. He was countering, he was picking his spots, and it really worked out well for him. Cormier probably had the best performance of the heavyweights. But outside of DC, there really wasn't a whole lot else to this card, so kind of disappointing overall. But as far as the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix goes, we now had our final four, as Barnett was scheduled to battle Sergey Kharitonov, while Overeem was expected to take on Bigfoot Silva Or would he? We all know that that would not happen, because I just mentioned that Overeem left after this bout. So who is Bigfoot Silva going to take on in that bout? Who is going to be matched up with who? Who were actually the final four going to be? I kind of gave you a little bit of a hint earlier on, but we'll discuss that more on an upcoming episode. So looking ahead, I'm not really sure what our next episode is going to be quite yet. I've put out some requests to fighters to come on. I haven't heard back anything yet, so I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do a fighter interview this week, or if it'll be me and Josh or me and somebody else breaking something down. We will see, and I will, of course, let you know. But after that, we're going to be covering Fedor versus Henderson, which is another heartbreaker for all the Fedor fans out there. We would also get Marluse Kunin defending her women's bantamweight belt against Misha Tate, as well as Paul Daly versus Tyron Woodley, Robbie Lawler versus Tim Kennedy, and Tarek Safadine versus Scott Smith. So that should be a good one. Looking forward to Josh being back and covering that with him. If you have not already, make sure that you follow us on social media. You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at the Hexagon Pod, and you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. And I would love to hear from you. And while, you know, this episode is, again, shorter than most of our event episodes, I hope that you're enjoying what we're doing. It's, you know, this has been a fun run. So let me take a couple minutes and just kind of talk to you about the show a little bit. You know, this is something that I do for fun. This isn't, you know, we're not, you know, making money at this. It's really just something that, you know, a passion project for me and Josh. Put a lot of hours into our research and try to make this as professional as we possibly can. And, you know, we've had some really, really fun interviews in the archives. I really enjoyed talking with John Morgan from MMA Junkie, Tim Kennedy. If you haven't listened to my interview with Rich Chow, the former Bellator and Strikeforce matchmaker, make sure you go back and check that out. I really enjoyed talking with him. Josh had a good interview with Kung Lee. I had a really fun interview with KJ Nunes. The story of Shine Fights, that debacle over in North Carolina that I was a part of, you definitely want to go back and listen to my interview with Ron Foster on that. Jake Shields, Scott Smith, Ben Folks, the celebrated MMA reporter, met Pat Miletich. We've had Frank Shamrock on a couple times, Babalu Sobral, Frank Trigg, Trevor Prangley, Gorgeous George Garcia, Joe Riggs, George Santiago. There's just some really great interviews, Gilbert Melendez, and of course Scott Coker, the man that started it all. So make sure, if you haven't already, go back and check those out. This is just a labor of love, and again, we've really enjoyed going through all of these episodes, and we still got a bunch more, but we're actually not going to have a ton left. I mean, it's November. We've still got plenty more months to go. We're actually scheduled to end in the month of April of 2022. That will be when we have gotten through all of the various interviews and all the various events and all that stuff. So yeah, at this point, we're supposed to end at the end of March, beginning of April. It just kind of depends on, you know, how much time we take off, and we'll probably take off a week or two during the holidays, but we'll see about that. But yeah, I really appreciate all your support. I really appreciate you tuning in and checking things out. And again, if you want to hear something different, or if you've got a suggestion, you want to put me in touch with a fighter or somebody that had something to do with Strikeforce, I am all ears on that. You can reach me again at phil@insidethehexagon.com. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. I hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy. We will see you soon.
Hi, listeners. We wanted to take a moment to tell you about another podcast from Evergreen Podcasts and Sound Talent Media called Pit Lane Parlay. Pit Lane Parlay is the go-to podcast for IndyCar and motorsports-related news. Each episode, we discuss things like our favorite drivers, news clips from the last week, and generally giving each other a hard time about predictions we've made in the past and or life stories that have come up recently. We really have a lot of fun with it and really enjoy each other's company, and we hope you can come join us too. Join Pit Lane Parlay by following us on your favorite podcast today.